This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We are going to learn how to grow food, even in a cold winter. Plus, the fine points of secretly planting food in public and private spaces. Gardening? Alex, don't you know Europe is nearing financial collapse? That North America and the whole global economy could experience a long-term crash? Can't you cover things that matter? Trust me, if any of that happens, growing or finding your own food will matter. A lot. We'll tell you how. We'll talk to the granddaddy of winter gardening, Elliot Coleman. If he can bring in fresh greens and even make money doing it in Maine winters without any heat in the greenhouses, you can do it anywhere in the United States, southern Canada, Britain, Scandinavia, and many parts of Russia, and you can do it cheap. We'll follow up with the details from an interview in an unheated greenhouse at the Center for Urban Organic Gardening in Guelph, Ontario, Canada. In between, we'll have a fun chat with Chris Tomlinson, the Gorilla Gardener of Love in the UK. We may have to sneak around a bit, putting food in waste spaces. If the UK economy crashes as hard as it looks, ordinary people will be grateful to find a little support from the landscape. Your town would be too. On the darker side, we'll hear a first-hand account of signs, the start of the global famine in an overheated world. One organic grower tells us why gardens in Austin, Texas failed in 2011, and it wasn't the drought. Don't miss it. Off we go to grow a quiet revolution. Nothing but paralysis or violence will come from the top. We need to start in the ground. We want fresh, organic, local food. Now, with a sour economy and rising food prices, that all just gets better. But most of us buy agribusiness produce in the winter when nature doesn't exactly encourage growing our own. Master gardener Elliot Coleman says we can grow food year-round, and you don't have to live in Florida or Southern California to do it. From his famous Four Seasons farm in Harborside, Maine, Elliot tells us how in his Winter Harvest Handbook. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Elliot Coleman, welcome to the program.
Hi, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
Well, growing fresh food in a New England winter, is that really possible?
Oh, it certainly is, and it's just a case of putting up enough protection to make the crops you're growing think that they aren't in New England but are somewhere milder. And you can get the first layer of protection very inexpensively with a simple plastic-covered hoop house. And by hoop house, I mean that it's constructed of bent pipes in the shape of a croquet wicket that are tall enough for you to walk under. There's one maybe every 4 feet, as long as you want to make it. And then you cover it with a sheet of clear plastic. It's best if it's greenhouse-grade plastic because the stuff you might buy at the hardware store is not protected against ultraviolet rays and will degrade quite quickly. So that first layer, that simple little translucent tunnel, will move the growing area about 1.5 USDA zones, and those are the zones in the map that tell you where you are vis-a-vis what will survive in the winter, depending on how low your temperatures get. 1.5 USDA zones, or here on the East Coast, about 500 miles to the south. So as I walk to the greenhouse on a normal winter morning, I'm in Maine. I walk into the greenhouse, I'm in a climate of New Jersey. So that's pretty neat. And I'm getting that without any heat input or any expense other than putting a plastic sheet over a simple frame. Then came the miraculous thing that we stumbled upon as we were first doing this. What if we put, let's say, a greenhouse inside the greenhouse? And the easiest way to do that was to put wire wickets over the beds in the greenhouse, one about every 4 feet, and then put a layer of one of those spun-bonded fabrics that you see on small tunnels in people's backyards that let air, light, and moisture pass. And all of a sudden, voila, you have the second layer. It moves the covered area another 500 miles to the south. And my greenhouse garden, instead of facing a Maine climate, is facing a Georgia winter climate. Now, that's pretty nice for spinach, for scallions, for Swiss chard, for any of the Asian greens, but it probably isn't going to allow you to grow tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants. And you can figure that out because they aren't growing tomatoes, peppers, and eggplants in Georgia in the winter. But you have a climate that will allow you to grow any of the hardy European or Asian crops that are traditionally grown in the winter in those parts of the world.
But you do heat some of your greenhouses. Why is that?
Well, we experimented around once we found that we could do with no heat at all with what could we do if we kept it just above freezing all winter. And we learned that because we did notice that crops are growing along very nicely until you get your first hard freeze under the inner layer in the greenhouse. And then they say, oh, whoops, I guess this is serious. And they slow down for about a week, and then they'll keep perking again. And we said, well, wow, what if we kept it just above freezing? Wouldn't that be neat? So we experimented with that for about 5 years, and it was amazing. We got double the yields and double the number of crops that would play this game. But the cost of propane really makes one wonder about whether it's worth doing it economically, and using non-renewables definitely made one wonder whether it was worth doing it from the point of view of the future of the planet. Now, we could have done it with a wood heat system, but what we learned from those 5 years of trials was that we were getting so much really good, exceptionally tasty food. And by exceptionally tasty, I mean that a lot of these cool weather crops love the cold of winter, if as long as they aren't outside being killed by the cold, dry winds. But we were getting so much good stuff from the unheated system, and that was so simple and uncomplicated that we decided that we would continue researching just along those lines.
Have you tried using water barrels to stabilize the day-to-night temperature swings?
Yes, there was a lot of work done in this country and a little bit done in Europe. Putting large translucent containers filled with water in the greenhouse that would be warmed up by the sun during the day and then give off heat at night. In most of those cases, though, it was done by people who were stuck in the old greenhouse image that the reason you put up a greenhouse is to grow tomatoes. That seems to be the knee-jerk reaction or the word that comes to everybody's mind when you mention greenhouse. And I suppose it's possible to do it with no supplemental heat if you have enough barrels collecting sun heat during the day. But the reason we never were interested in it at all is because you don't have enough sun in the winter, long enough days, to make good-tasting tomatoes. It doesn't make any difference whether you have them. If they don't taste good, they aren't worth eating. Whereas the cool-weather crops, like spinach and chard and scallions and carrots and the Asian greens, are spectacularly flavorful in the winter without the stress of heat. And so the other disadvantage of putting a lot of water-filled containers in the greenhouse is that they're taking up the space that could be growing crops. And whereas the hardy winter crops need no more protection than those two layers under which they are being warmed at night by the heat coming out of the earth, which was stored there during the day from the sun shining in, that's turned out to be so simple and so tasty that why complicate it?
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest Elliot Coleman. We're talking about winter gardening. Elliot, maybe we should let listeners know a little bit more about you. Tell us about Four Season Farm and your partner Barbara, if you like.
Well, Four Season Farm is a wonderful story. Back in 1968, I had very little money and a compelling desire to want a farm, and all I could afford was some land that was covered with spruce and fir trees. Well, I was an adventurer, and that sounded like an adventure. So over the course of time, I've cleared 14 acres of that, worked very hard by bringing in organic matter and all sorts of nice minerals like lime and phosphate rock, to create an exceptionally fertile soil out of the poor forest soil we started with. And so Four Season Farm has been some sort of adventurer's dream of how much fun farming could be if you started with nothing and figured out how to be able to grow anything you ever wanted to eat. And that's basically what we do. And further to the fact that we're on the coast of Maine, way up here in the north, Alex, is the fact that if we'd figured out this winter production on a farm in Virginia, let's say, everybody would have said, well, that's nice for Virginia on south, but you could never do it further north. So the fact that we're farther north than anybody and we're doing it really gets people to brighten up and say, oh my gosh, I can do that in my backyard.
And you two had a TV show as well?
Barbara and I were asked by the Learning Channel back in 1992 to do a TV show. It was called Gardening Naturally. And it was interesting because since we're way up here where we are behind everybody else's climate in the spring, we couldn't do it the way gardening TV shows are often done, where they're showing you what you should be doing in the garden that week. And so we set it up as if it were a book, and there'd be a chapter on tomatoes, there'd be a chapter on growing broccoli, or a chapter on different herbs or shrubs or flowers in the garden. And we did 52 episodes in total, 26 each in 1993 and 1994. And I always thought it was the best gardening TV show ever done, but then again, I'm probably prejudiced.
Well, before we get back to winter gardening, could you tell us briefly about the other books that you've published?
The first book I wrote was called The New Organic Grower, and that first came out back in 1988. And I'd been in this game since 1965, and during those years, trying to learn how to farm organically and grow things successfully, I had gone and visited an awful lot of very smart, very nice people who were kind enough to share information with me. And I wrote that book as a way of paying them back by passing it on to future generations. So that's basically a textbook on organic gardening and farming. The second book was back when we were first experimenting around with winter production in our home garden. And it's written for home gardeners. It's called Four Season Harvest. And it just explains some of the simple techniques we used when we were first figuring out, oh my gosh, you can eat fresh food in January, and isn't that neat? And then the third book, as we got into doing it on a commercial basis on the farm here, the Winter Harvest Handbook is aimed at commercial growers and large-scale home gardeners who want to get really serious about this and feed not only themselves but a few neighbors also.
You brought up one of the second challenges of winter gardening, which is not just the temperature but the lack of sunlight in the winter, and I've got kind of a crazy question for you. Would it make any sense to add grow lights like the marijuana growers use?
Well, if I were growing produce that was worth as much as what they grow, I suppose I could afford to add in almost any input like that. But two things guide us. First off, there's the economics of what we might want to do. But the second is it going to get us produce that's as good as naturally grown produce? And if you picture the coast of Europe, you can go as far up as parts of Norway, which are way up there. And because of the Gulf Stream, they have a reasonably mild winter climate, and crops are even growing out of doors in the winter, although they have very short days. And yet that produce is perfectly healthy. It's feeding the deer and the antelope and anybody else who's wandering around. So if we were worried about length of day, we might want to put in artificial light, but we aren't because all the crops we're growing seem to enjoy the amount of day there is. But the second factor is that I don't know if all of the rays or different photons or whatever you might want to call them that come from the sun are able to be reproduced by the lights that are presently available. And so I would be then stimulating my plants with an artificial light.
I notice you're not using a lot of plastic pots or even growing benches. Instead, you use the soil right on the greenhouse floor. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a good question, Alex. What the greenhouse floor does for us, the soil there, it does the same thing people were trying to get those water-filled barrels doing years ago. It stores the heat during the day. And then by having that low cover a foot above it held up on the wire wickets inside the greenhouse, that area is extra protected on a cold winter night. The temperature difference is such that when it's, let's say, 15 below zero Fahrenheit outdoors here in Maine, the low that night will be about 18 degrees above Fahrenheit under the inner layer. Now, as I said, that certainly rules out tomatoes and cucumbers, but all the hardy crops I've mentioned, they think that's just great. They don't mind freezing at night as long as the next morning the sun comes out, and as I say, when I lift up that inner layer in the morning and look under there, it looks like a perpetual spring.
And some people set their greenhouses in concrete, and you move your greenhouses around. Why is that?
Well, if you read up on the greenhouse literature, you can find that after a number of years, you can get into problems in a perpetually covered area like that. You can get a buildup of pests and diseases. You can get a buildup of excess nutrients because they aren't being flushed out by rain during the course of the year. By having a movable greenhouse, we gain two things. We get to take it off the land that it was on and put it over a new clean piece of land and let the old land get winded on, rained on, sunned on, et cetera, and clean back up again. But also, we get to grow heat-loving crops in that greenhouse during the summer. For us here on the coast of Maine, it really speeds up the tomatoes and the eggplant and the peppers to have them in a greenhouse. And then we can leave those plants growing in that greenhouse as long as they will grow or before it freezes enough to freeze through there and kill them. And meanwhile, we have gotten the winter crops started, which need to be started before winter, on the plot next door. And then sometime in late October, early November, we just slide the greenhouse over to the winter crops. They're glad to have this a blanket of protection over them because they were beginning to get a little worried as the temperatures got colder. And we've gained both by cleaning up the soil and by having one greenhouse serve two purposes.
That just makes so much sense. Well, on another topic, when I was trying to feed our family from the land, I did read up about the way New England pioneers would force vegetables in their basements, even without light. I never tried it. Have you tried it?
Oh, yes. In fact, there are some wonderful games you can play that way that we learned years ago when before we had a greenhouse when we were trying to eat. And, for example, when we store cabbage in the fall in our root cellar, we pull it out of the ground, stems and all, break off the loose outer leaves, and put this sort of bare head with a stem and roots in the floor of the cellar. Then when we want to eat a cabbage, we bring that whole thing into the kitchen, cut the head off, and replant the roots and stem in a bucket of damp sand in a sunny window. All the stored nutrients in that stem, which would be used next spring to send up shoots and leaves in the process of making seed, suddenly burst out in greenery all along that stem, delicious edible greenery. So basically, we've forced a part of the plant that most people would never think had anything edible in it at all, and it turns out to have a bunch of winter salads.
And Elliot, you don't just grow food, you sell it. How is the market for fresh produce in the winter?
Oh, the market is endless. In fact, I had a wonderful customer when we first started doing it after a couple of years. She told me that in the old days, she said she used to suffer through the winter looking forward to the great range of local fresh produce available in the summer. And she said now she puts up with the summer looking forward to the great range of fresh produce available all winter long. So it's really made a difference, and especially if you live way up in New England and winter's long and it's dark and it's cold and it's snowy. When you can go to the local market and there's a fresh baby leaf salad looking like it's May rather than January, it's a wonderful way to live.
Considering oil prices are always likely to go up in the long run, do you think we'll see a decline in food shipped from the South or even from overseas?
I suspect, but the oil prices will have to go up quite a lot. If you ever calculate the number, I think it's probably 30,000 heads of lettuce in a semi coming from California, and put that up against the amount of fuel that's being used, you would probably find that you could double or triple or quadruple the price of the fuel, and it would only add maybe 5 cents to the cost of each lettuce. But the reason that local produce is going to become more and more popular is because it's fresher. All the chefs in the restaurants we sell to, they love our baby leaf winter salad because they say when they get it from us, it's good and beautiful for up to 10 days. Whereas when they buy the California produce, it's a week old by the time it gets to them, and they're lucky if it has a three-day life. So it's freshness and flavor that are going to win out for the local fresh food business.
Elliot Coleman, if we've inspired some listeners to get started in winter gardening, how do they find your website and your winter harvest handbook?
Well, our website is fourseasonfarm.com. There's no S on the end of season, just fourseasonfarm.com. And you can see pretty pictures there of what we do, and different articles have been written about us or by us. And almost any bookstore, if you ask them to order it, can get you a copy of any one of my three books or the Winter Harvest Handbook if you want to be up to date with the latest information. And if you're like anything like all the people who have written us letters over the years, you're going to be just amazingly enthusiastic about what you can do in a season when you never thought you could do anything.
I notice you have an all-star cast recommending the book, everybody from Martha Stewart to Michael Pollan and Paul Hawken. Are you also plugged into the localization movement?
Oh, I think that is the most fascinating thing, Alex. The local food movement, if you look at it, I think over the last 5 or 6 years, has gone to where organic took 40 years to get to in a very short period of time. And, you know, that has to do with the fact that local means fresh, but also people like buying from a farmer who's right next door. I saw a bumper sticker once in favor of that, and the bumper sticker said, "Eat your view." And basically, it was pointing out to people that if there aren't any farms around you, there's nothing pretty to look at. So the best way to keep farms around you is to buy food from your local farmers, and then they will keep farming, and you will have something pretty to look at.
Yes, and we've talked to other farmers about all the ecosystem services that farms provide, from capturing rainwater and stabilizing all sorts of things. So it's really very necessary. As we finish off, is there something else that you'd like to add?
just when you try this and get to taste how good some of these crops taste in the cool of winter, take some to your neighbors. Spread the word. This is really fun, and it's the type of thing that everybody in your community is going to want to do eventually. And then you can have gardening competitions in February as well as in July over who has the biggest and the best.
Maybe we'll have a February Harvest Festival. You have been listening to Master Organic Grower Elliot Coleman. He produces food year-round in Harborside, Maine. Find his Winter Harvest Handbook and other garden reading at fourseasonfarm.com. Elliot, you have inspired me to give this a try. Thank you for sharing with us.
Oh, you're welcome, Alec, and it's been my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. All those public lands clothed in lawns and decorative trees, they don't do anybody any good, and people are going hungry. Why haven't authorities clued in to the rising cost of food and poverty? I'm Alex Smith. We live in a lost landscape of the Victorian and middle-class city. Chris Tomlinson and the Gorillas of Love are determined to change all that. In the UK, Chris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, EcoShock people. Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a gorilla gardener.
It starts from, there was a book called The Green Pages, written by John Button back about 10 years ago now. And being a vegan from 1987, he kind of picked up on the issue of vegans are just as much consumerists as the rest of sort of normal folk who might have other diets, to which as usual, I read a lot, and it sort of prodded my conscience, and it sort of progressed from there. I started to grow my own food with an allotment, and then from that allotment, I got so addicted, I thought, sod just growing in allotment sites, take it further and grow in local neighbourhoods.
Are you still active in Nottingham, or have you moved on?
I've moved from Nottingham, and when I was staying in Hastings, I planted quite a few trees and perennial vegetables and what have you, really, stuff like that.
And seeds don't cost a lot, but fruit and nut trees do. Where would you get the funding for that?
They got the funding for getting the fruit trees. I've not really yet done nut trees. It's interesting you raised that, because that would be inevitable progression. Got the funding from Ecotricity and the Lush Cosmetics people, who have sort of shops around the world, I believe.
What tips do you have for people who want to give it a try? How do we do it?
Well, first of all, it's interesting to say about cost-effective is, so I just went to, I'm sure around the world there's different people, different sites for this, but it's a thing called FreeCycle, where you can sort of go online and offer your goods or things you can offer, skills or actual products. And I put an ad out for free for seeds, and I had a year's supply. So that was quite amazing. So it didn't cost me a penny for the seeds, and for the trees, as I say, I got funding. And coincidentally, I get the trees from Agroforestry Research Trust, Martin Crawford's charity that he set up, which is a really interesting little project.
Do you have to sneak about at night, or can you just casually walk up and plant a place, maybe dressed as a plausible city worker, or what? How do you do that?
It helps if you get yourself a fluorescent jacket. I've got one with Brighton Hove written on the back, so it's exactly what the council workers would use if you want to do it in the daytime. But planting a tree can be quite a lot, can take a bit of a while, so yeah, I've planted them in the small hours. Yeah.
And what sort of places do you look for to do your planting?
Oh, unbelievably. I've planted, most of my successes have been in people's front gardens and public parks as well, and just to sort of blend in. Actually, in Hastings, they kindly actually put a tree guard around one of my trees and mulched it for me, because I obviously thought it was one of theirs. So camouflage your trees and have it done by your local council.
They adopted your tree. I love it. Well, what about the authorities? Have you had any problems with the police, or have you even had food plantings ripped out?
Yeah, I've had, unfortunately, it's the trees that go first, because they just stand out. So I've had quite a few trees lost, about up to, I think it's about at least five now. And had I had trouble with the police, I've actually had a stop and search. And a run-in with one, PC Marriott, and he was fine, though. He said he's got an allotment in Battle. He was a nice side of the police. So it's not all bad. It's all sort of, it's wins and losses. And
yeah, it's terrible to be caught with those carrot seeds in your pockets.
Because the worst thing that can happen in England, it's civil offence. So it's just sort of minor trespass. I mean, the landowner can issue a notice to leave his land, or you could just be fined, which would be quite ironic when I consider it as quite a noble thing that I do, actually enhancing sort of rundown areas. I do operate in waste grounds, and I've been picked up on disturbing pieces of ground before because of wild sort of plants that might not be weeds to the unseen eye. And I'm trained in horticulture, so I understand not just to get into a piece of ground and rip anything out and replace it. Be quite sensitive on what you're doing, really, and read a good book on gardening, because it is gardening after all.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more from the guerrilla gardener Chris Tomlinson, plus the first signs of the coming global famine from a grower in Austin, Texas.